True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, among others. They'll do all of that so you can do literally anything else. You have better things to do with your free time than focus on your lawn care. Let True Green take care of all the hard work it takes to get a great lawn while you take care of everything else on your to-do list. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which gives you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. Think about how hard it is to manage our fantasy baseball teams. You need all the time you can get to put in waiver wire claims, fab bids, send out trades, and set your lineups. You'll have that extra time when True Green is taking care of your lawn. You do you, let True Green do your lawn care. Visit truegreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed.
Welcome to the Fantasy Baseball Today podcast from CBS Sports.
High drive, center field, hit the wall, grand slam. This is magnificent.
Got a fantasy question? Email fantasybaseball@cbsi.com. Get ready to win your league.
Where fantasy becomes reality.
Now, here's Frank, Scott, Chris, and Adam.
Sleepers, breakouts, and busts are in the books for now. But welcome into Fantasy Baseball Today. This is our official strategy podcast. Trying something new this year. It was a light day of spring training action, so I wanted to dedicate an entire podcast to just game theory and strategy for all of the different formats. We're going to try and get to everything today. Head-to-head points, roto, head-to-head categories, salary cap leagues, some AL only, NL only, dynasty, some in-season stuff as well. We'll hit it all. Today, this is our official strategy podcast. But before all of that, last year, I would like to say that we were collectively the Corey Seager podcast. That was official. We were all on record. We were very excited about Corey Seager.
Upon talking,
Zach Gallen. We like Gallen a lot as well. We also liked Rich Hill. So, I mean, can only pump up the things that we were right about. So, upon talking to you guys before we got started, I just realized that we are officially the Miles Straw podcast.
I love to see it.
I did not know this, but we're comparing, contrasting our great fantasy baseball invitational teams, 15 team roto drafts. And I'm like, yeah, my outfield stinks. I got Miles Straw as my fifth outfielder. Scott goes, wait, I have Miles Straw as my fifth outfielder. And then Chris goes, I can do you one better. He's my fourth outfielder. How about that? Miles Straw.
Yeah, I mean, he's 4A, 4B with Christian Pache, you know, either one of them. You take any given day. It's not ideal.
Oh, I'm fine with it. I'm fine with it. This is, I needed some steel still. And if he is the Astros' everyday center fielder, he will contribute steals. If he's the Astros' everyday leadoff hitter, which seems to be the direction they're leaning right now, then he'll contribute a lot of runs too. So I think he's a legit sleeper. I mean, The non-power hitter profile is a difficult one to land in today's environment. And, you know, maybe pitchers will find out there's nothing to fear there and just blow the bat out of his hands and it's all over at that point. But I'll take the chance given the role that the Astros are carving out for him. And, you know, obviously a solid minor league track record.
Yeah, he's averaged his 150-game pace between AA and AAA is 65 stolen bases with like a 90% success rate, I think.
Yeah, 170 steals in the minors, 43 caught stealing. So that is a great success rate. And back in 2018, he stole 70 bases in the minors. With all that being said, he does have four home runs in 469 career games in the minors there. So that is all the player analysis that you will get today. Miles Straw. So I hope you enjoyed it. The rest will just be strategy. Let's jump right in so we can get to as much of these formats as we possibly can. Rotisserie, also known as Roto, also known as the standard 5x5 format. And if you didn't listen to it, go back and listen to our Saturday mailbag from this past weekend. We explained the differences between each format. We didn't talk as much about our specific strategies. I wanted to save that for today, but we more so focused on what goes into our rankings and explaining just the differences between specifically Roto, head-to-head points, and head-to-head categories. So we did that on our mailbag this past weekend. Before we get into the actual strategy for rotisserie leagues, some have emailed in and asked about category targets. What should you be trying to achieve in each of your categories. And this changes year in and year out, but I looked back at the hitting targets from 2019, which was obviously the last full season, and based on an article that Chris, our very own Chris Towers, wrote last year, assuming 12-team leagues with your standard categories, this is what you needed to finish in first place in each back in 2019. A 278 batting average, 383 home runs, 1,183 runs scored, 1,137 RBI, and 152 steals. That means the average 5x5 line that you should target for each of your hitters, it's not going to work out this way, but people have asked this as well. 278 batting average, 27 home runs, 84 runs scored, 81 RBI, and 10.8 steals. You know, good luck finding 10.8 steals
from your catcher. That's to win every category. Right. That's to win it, which you don't need to do, I think.
Correct.
Years ago, I remember Tristan Cockcroft, who writes for ESPN now, he had a rule that he wanted to finish fourth in every category, which will probably work out more times, more often than not, if you do that. But, you know, obviously you're not going to have a steady finish across the board anyway. But like that's just something to keep in mind. You don't have to win every category or any category.
It's a good point. And you only have to win each counting stat category by one. So having the most steals in the world, sure, it's beneficial. If trading is allowed in your league, then you could trade off some of your steals once you get into first place. But you only need to win the category by one. So keep that in mind. And speaking of steals, just to remind everybody, the scarcity of steals in a roto league. In 2019, there were just 2,280 steals across baseball. That was the lowest total for a full season since 1973. So they are down. Last year, based on last year's numbers, they were actually on pace over 162 games for, I think it was 2,400 steals.
So, yeah, 2,467. I just did a look at, I just averaged the plate appearances from 2016 to 2019 and then paced that out for 2020. And it would have been 2,467. So a couple hundred more.
So that's good.
But still the second lowest of the last 4-5 years.
Yeah, so if you're wondering why we're drafting Miles Straw in a 15-team roto league, that's exactly why. Because steals are not easy to come by. On the pitching side, this is what you needed to finish first in each category back in 2019. 103 wins, 100 saves, 1,622 strikeouts, a 3.497 ERA, a 1.131 whip. So say you start 6 starting pitchers and 3 relief pitchers, you roughly need 11 wins per pitcher, 33 saves per each of your relievers. Good luck with that. And 180 strikeouts per pitching slot. With all of that being said, Scott, we'll start with you. What is your strategy when it comes to drafting in a roto league? Do you target specific positions or specific categories earlier in the draft? I assume this is where you wax poetic about pitchers.
Well, of course. The scarcity in every league is high-end pitching is pitching that isn't going to destroy you, basically. And that you can only feel confident about drafting early. But, you know, the single biggest scarcity in roto league specifically, 5x5 leagues, is stolen bases. So the hitters, I mean, that's why Mike Trout never goes number one overall anymore, right? I mean, he's still as good of a hitter as he ever was, but he's not really contributing to that category in a way others like Ronald Acuna and Fernando Tatis and even like Juan Soto are. So it's really kind of overtaken the game just because there are so few players that contribute to it and it's as essential a category as any. So, you know, ideally you would get a pretty nice start in that category. I find that I am too interested in taking pitchers and too interested in taking non-base stealing values like Corey Seager and Alex Bregman and Anthony Rendon. It's rare that I actually get many steals early on, you know, unless I happen to pick very early and can take like an Acuna or Tatis type. It's rare that I actually do that. And, you know, I'm not that worried about it. I'm not as worried as I was last year. I feel like there are more, and you know, Chris mentioned this, the steals pace actually went up across the league last year. I feel like there are more mid and late route fallback options for that category than there were last year. Guys like Miles Straw, guys like John Birdie,
Nick Madrigal,
Tommy Edman in the middle rounds, and a lot more. You know, you don't need a lot of steals to be competitive in the category. That's one category I don't aim to win. I just want to finish kind of in the middle of the pack. And I think you can do that without making a huge investment in it. Still, it's optimal to get it, to get some contribution to that early.
And yeah, if you get 100, you're probably going to finish around the middle of the pack. In 2019, 103 was seventh place. 108 was sixth place. So
Chris, same for 100.
Six or seven per roster spot.
Early on in a roto draft, the hitters that I want to target are at least contribute in one of batting average or steals. So, Scott, you mentioned that you like to target Bregman and Corey Seager, even Anthony Rendon. We all like him as well. I mean, those are going to be, hopefully, with Bregman as well, four category contributors where they afford you the luxury to take steals contributors later on in your drafts that are not going to give you power, or they might be a drain on your batting average. You get that early on, and then you could take some chances on some steals guys later, and the same thing with power if you need that late in your draft. Chris, do you have a specific roto strategy that you like to use?
It's like Scott said, it's more about stat scarcity than positional scarcity. You can find in a 12-team league, especially with the exception of catcher, there's probably someone you'll feel good about starting at pretty much every spot, assuming you don't wait until the 20th round to start drafting hitters. But for me, I think my general strategy in roto is probably one pitcher by the hopefully first two rounds, another pitcher in the fifth and sixth round range, and then I really like the 100 to 150 range in ADP for starting pitcher, so I probably get like my number 3, 4, and 5 starters out of that group. I wrote about that on CBS Sports last week. So, you know, I think, you know, Scott and I disagree a lot about starting pitchers famously, but it's funny. In the end, we kind of both have the same strategy. Like, we're both aiming for five of the top, like yours is like top 35 or so.
Yeah. Mine, which roughly translates to five of my first picks. First 10 picks in starting pitchers.
Yeah. Mine is more like, let me look at my rankings and see, like,
based on what you're saying, Chris,
five of my top 40 to 45 ish.
Yeah. I was going to say 45 makes sense for you,
which is different. But, you know, once you get down there, I think, you know, Scott, I think you have Dylan Bundy as a top 35 pitcher. I have him as a top 45 pitcher. So it's, you know, It's mostly we just like different guys.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see how it would come down to that. And I'll also point out that it's easier to justify five starting pitchers with the first 10 picks in something like a 12 team league versus something like a 15 team league when I just couldn't do it. I mean, I spent three of my first four picks on starting pitchers in TGFBI here. And then I took a fourth one, I think in round 8, but I couldn't get that fifth one in. It was just sacrificing too much. And it was already clear in a 15-team league that I had a pretty big starting pitcher advantage. So,
yeah,
you know, deeper leagues like that, you obviously have to be reasonable. But the bottom line is I want to try to have the strongest pitching staff coming out of the draft because bad things are going to happen to everybody's pitching staff, and I want to be the one everybody comes to when the bad things happen to overpay and for pitching.
To be clear, when we say pitcher in this context, we're talking about starting pitcher.
Yeah. Correct. Right.
I don't think any of the three of us is all that interested in spending a top 100 pick on a relief pitcher. I don't think I've done it.
No.
In any draft this year. And in TGFBI, which is a 15 team league, I have zero relievers through 24 rounds. I'm not saying that's a great idea.
Oh my gosh.
But you know, there are so many unsettled closer spots this year at this point that, you know, hopefully by the end of the spring, we'll have answers. But, you know, if you go back to our relief pitcher preview, it was close to half the league who we just didn't really have a strong sense of who the closer would be. So if you throw, you know, three darts at the end of the round and you hit on at the end of the draft and you hit on two of them, you know, that's a viable strategy for relief pitcher as well. So, yeah, for me,
that's pretty much my strategy at this point at relief pitcher. Unless there's a really high impact, potentially high impact guy that falls, which we talked about on the relief pitcher preview. For me, that's James Karinczak,
Trevor Rosenthal,
seems to fall. He's dealing with a groin injury now, so we'll see what happens there. But it doesn't sound like a big deal. Will Smith for the Braves, I think, is on the lower end of that. And kind of Amir Garrett, though. Amir Garrett tends to go so late that he kind of fits into the strategy of just waiting till the end.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I'm loading up on like the Greg Hollins, the Joaquin Sorias,
Daniel Bard.
Daniel Bard, that's the name I was thinking of for the Rockies. Yeah, because like they look like they're in position to be their team's closers. And, you know, even if they're not good enough to keep the job, whatever, that's going to go for half the position. The closers you draft are very unlikely to be your save sources all season long. I just want to try and narrow down the guys who are going to be there at the beginning.
I will say, I agree. I'm not going to use a top 100 pick on a closer usually, but top 150, I think I will. I'll try to get one of my top 12. I mentioned in the relief pitcher preview that 10 to 12 range. That's the last of the ones that I feel good about. And again, that's a relative term among relief pitchers, but you know, guys like Craig Kimbrell and Kirby Yates, and right in that mix.
Just to highlight what middle of the road in the save category looked like in 2019. You could finish sixth place with 66 saves.
Okay. So, yeah, that's about 22 saves per relief pitcher spot. Assuming, Chris, let me ask you, you have 9 pitcher spots in a roto league. You're starting, usually, is it 6 starting pitchers and 3 relief pitchers, 7 and 2?
That depends how the draft goes. In TGFBI, right. We'll probably be starting 9 starting pitchers to open the season, and we'll see what happens. You know, it depends on the relievers. I'm not going to start... ideally I would rather not start a like 4.5 ERA closer just because he's getting saves. If he's one of two that I have, I might not have a choice, but I think the ideal would be 2 pretty good closers if you can get them.
It's rare to see a guy with a 4.50 ERA keep that role for long anymore. Like the days of Mike Williams.
Yeah.
Closing, like that's you don't see a lot of that anymore, but I do. Okay. So you said 66 saves was good for 6th place 2 years ago, Chris.
Yeah.
In a 12 team.
And what was first place?
100.
Like, here's the thing. I feel like saves is the easiest category to win. I go into every year planning on winning saves without making that big of an investment in relief pitcher. Because like, if you're just consistent about pursuing those guys on the waiver wire, you don't got to try and like, you know, there are some new closer candidates, particularly early in the year with everybody blows out their budget to pick up. But at some point, saves fatigue will set in and it gets a lot easier to get those guys. And have to be consistent about it.
You just look at like a situation like Cleveland where they have, you know, I think we all probably agree James Karinchak is the best option there, but Nick Whitgren's a really good reliever, and Emmanuel Classe could be a lights out closer. That was the scouting report on him when they traded Corey Kluber for him. So, you know, if Karinchak, you know, he threw 9 straight balls in a recent outing. I think I read that in Scott's spring notebooks column. You know, if he falters or if they just don't trust him, it could be Nick Whitgren. And if Nick Whitgren failed, like there are more good relievers than good closers.
If
you're active on the, like, shooting for 100 saves on draft day is way overkill. Like if you're the kind of person who wants to get locked down elite closers, take Liam Hendricks and Aroldis Chapman and don't think about it ever again. Because if you're investing that much in those two guys, if they lose their jobs, it's like there's no point in having a backup.
And there are different ways to win in fantasy and specifically in roto. Just because we're telling you not to use a top 100 pick on a reliever doesn't mean that it can't work. And I know you brought this up before as well, Chris, that if there's ever a year to target those guys like Liam Hendricks and Chapman, say they pitch, you know, 60 to 70 innings each, that can be with the ratios that they give you, that can be half of an elite starting pitcher. An elite starting pitcher might only give you 150 innings this year.
And that's something to keep in mind when you're building your roto league is when you're looking at ratios, so specifically average, ERA, and WHIP, you have to think about the numerator and the denominator, so the amount of runs allowed and the innings pitched. And in this season, your innings pitch total is almost certainly going to be lower. I'm not sure. I think it's like 1,200 or 1,400 innings pitched is what you usually end up with, what the average fantasy team ends up with in a 12-team league. You know, this year that might be 1,200. And so that's something to keep in mind, is the elite relievers should have a bigger impact on your ratios, which doesn't just apply to a Liam Hendricks, but it could also apply to a James Karinchak if he doesn't get saves, or a Nick Anderson, or
Devin Williams.
Any of those guys, Devin right. Williams. And then that also, you know, both makes a low inning elite pitcher potentially more valuable if you can get them at a discount. And, you know, if Trevor Bauer pitches 210 innings with a 3 ERA, that's going to be hugely valuable.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yep. Good stuff there. Before we get to head-to-head points, I do want to promote a few things. It is the month of madness, and the Ion College Basketball Podcast is here as your audio guide for the entire NCAA tournament. Gary Parrish and Matt Norlander will offer a complete breakdown as soon as the bracket is announced on Sunday, so you stand a chance in your pool this year. The coverage continues with reactions after each day of games and previews of upcoming rounds. If you want the best March Madness analysis, subscribe to the Eye on College Basketball Podcast anywhere you find this podcast, Fantasy Baseball Today. Speaking of March Madness, you can create a pool to compete against your friends or fill out your bracket for the chance to win a Nissan Rogue and a trip to the 2022 Final Four. You can play on the CBS Sports app or at cbssports.com/brackets. All right, let's talk about head-to-head points leagues now, and specifically the strategy here. This is probably... Do you have the breakdown, Chris? Is this the most played format on CBS Sports Leagues, head-to-head points? I feel like
it is. I think it's a plurality, but not a majority.
Okay.
Or something like that.
Okay. Whatever that means.
it's but, the most, but not most.
And
less than 50%.
Yes. I will point out that I love the head-to-head points format, but I've got to come clean. I think that... I talk about points leagues less than Adam Azer used to, because I'm going to lose some people here, man. But I don't think that there is much strategy involved in a head-to-head points league as there is in a roto or even a head-to-head categories league, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But I think in a head-to-head points leagues, you want to be aggressive on starting pitchers early. You want to target hitters with strong plate discipline who bat in the top half of really good lineups, because those hitters will get more plate appearances than hitters on bad teams, just because obviously they're making more plate appearances, and they're and plate appearances equal more fantasy points. So with that being said, Scott, what is your general head-to-head points strategy? Are you more aggressive on starting pitchers in this format compared to any of the others?
I think probably I'm still trying to figure out exactly what I want. We haven't done enough mocks for head-to-head points leagues yet. We're doing one later this week. It's the format I've played for the longest. It's the format I've probably done the best in, by and large. But it's, you know, it's what you're saying. There's some truth to it, I think, Frank, given what the environment's become, where hitting is so plentiful and there are so few lineup spots to fill. I'm about to the point, and I want to rehearse this a few times before I get all the way there, but I'm about to the point where I just want to draft pitchers until all the good ones are gone, and then just take whatever's left at hitting and trust myself to fill in those hitter spots as optimally as I can over the course of the season. And just, you know, make sure I don't get screwed on pitching, because everybody's going to push them up their draft boards. I think I'm about to that point. You know, would I pass up Mike Trout in round two? Probably not. But barring something excessive like that, I think I want to try that next time, because I mean, I didn't win the Podcast Listeners League last year. And it was probably the worst finish I had. And it was because I shortchanged pitching. You know, I didn't think I was shortchanging pitching as the draft was playing out, but that it turns out that's what happened.
And that's exactly why I rank the big three starting pitchers, Jacob deGrom, Gerrit Cole, and Shane Bieber, as my top three players in a head-to-head points league this year, Scott, is because I had the first overall pick in our podcast league last year, head-to-head points, and I took Christian Yelich. And by the time starting pitcher came back to me, I think I took Lucas Giolito and Charlie Morton, which, okay, I think those were two of my top 15, but it did not work out very well. And I think once the season started, I ended up trading Yelich away for Kershaw and Austin Meadows. I think that was the trade. But you just can never have enough pitching. And the reason why we bring that up in a head-to-head points league is that if you have bad pitching, you are going to get potentially single-digit points out of a start. You might even get negative points out of a start. And you can chase two start pitchers, which I think is becoming a little bit outdated.
Yeah, it used to be a way to make up for having a suspect pitching staff. But like the disappearance of the middle class at starting pitcher is really ruined the two start streaming strategy, which, you know, that's not all a bad thing because it was kind of a lame strategy. It kind of ruined the whole head to head points league aspect for some people. It didn't do it for me, obviously, but it kind of did for some people. I don't think that's a reliable strategy at all anymore.
Yeah. And you pick up two star pitchers. These guys could blow up twice in your lineup. You could get negative points from two starts in a pitcher in the same week. I mean, that's why the elite starting pitcher is as valuable as I think it is at this point in a head-to-head points league. Chris, do you have a specific strategy in this format?
I definitely draft starting pitcher a little earlier. And just, you know, we haven't done like a regular head-to-head points mock draft in a while, but we did do a salary cap draft recently. And 29 of the top 59 players in salary were starting pitchers. That's 29 of the 59 players with a salary over $20. So, you know, that is when you think about how the history of salary cap drafts has usually been, what, 180-80 has been the kind of idealized split. 180 of your budget for pit hitters, 80 for your pitchers, something like that. That's a significant change. And, you know, one thing I will say is there are definitely in head-to-head points because the push for pitching has gotten so extreme. I think zigging when everyone's zagging is a viable strategy. Because you can end up with, you know, five or six top 25 hitters if you pursue that strategy. And that can give you an edge still, because yes, you could have five or six top 25 starting pitchers, but historically three of those are going to be good. One of them is going to be nothing. And two of them you might drop.
Where do you get your pitchers if you...
Oh, sure. That's always a question. Like, yeah.
If Sandy Alcantara is your ace, I don't think it matters.
Yeah, no, I don't think Sandy Alcantara should be your ace. But yeah, I think zigging when everyone else is zagging is always a viable strategy, I guess, is the way I would say it. It's not necessarily always going to work out, but, you know, one thing about fantasy sports at this point, and I've said this for both football and baseball the last couple of years, is the markets are so efficient. It's so hard to find players who are truly undervalued that if everyone's pursuing the same strategy, or if 9 out of 12 teams in your league are pursuing the same strategy, that means you have to be better at that strategy than 9 different people.
Chris, I think you probably have the strongest hands ever. Because whenever I hear you type on the podcast, it sounds so ferocious. Like, it is rapid and it's ferocious. And it's like, I hear it very clearly come through. It used to be louder, actually, when you had the lav mic. So it's gotten better. But
my wife was so upset when I told her I was getting a mechanical keyboard for my new computer. Because it's the clickety clack, you know, that thing. She hates it. It's really bad that I'm a writer. Because I type very fast and very loud.
Why would you do that, Chris? Why would you get that?
Oh, because it's just such a better experience when you're typing.
I do agree with that.
And for gaming.
Yeah.
It's better for gaming. Mm-hmm. It's more responsive.
Yeah, I don't know much about the keyboard for the gaming, but definitely enjoy the mechanical keyboard when it comes to writing. Go ahead, Scott.
I did want to add something else here just so we don't make the entire conversation about pitching. I do think you have to play the position scarcity game a little more in head-to-head points leagues than you do in roto, because you know there are going to be positions in a roto league because there are so many to fill where everybody's just going to have some kind of not so great players. But in head-to-head points league, that's not necessarily true. You have so few hitter spots to work with. As much impact as you can get in each of them is like, you don't want to be the guy who gets Didi Gregorius as a starting shortstop in a points league. Not that Didi Gregorius is bad. You could win with Didi Gregorius as your shortstop, but you'll be at a clear disadvantage at that position versus everybody you play. And I know this kind of contradicts what I was saying about starting pitchers, because how are you supposed to have an impact player at every hitter position if you've used all your early picks on pitchers? But I think you can shoot for upside. I think you can target the deeper positions later. The head-to-head points league is probably the position where I'm most likely to invest in catcher for that reason. Like it's you have to differentiate yourself somehow, and that's one of nine hitter spots where you can do that. So I'm not saying I need JT Realmuto necessarily, but you know, I don't, you know, if I can get Salvador Perez for a good price, or you know, if I want to shoot for the moon with Mitch Garver over somebody boring and safe, like, I don't know, Christian Vasquez, I'd probably do that. You know, there are times when catcher's still the last position I fill in this format, just because it's the way I work. It works out, but I'm more likely to invest in a catcher in this format than I am even in like a two catcher roto league.
And I think the positions to wait on, probably shortstop in a head-to-head points league, because we talked about there's kind of that top 13.
You got to pay attention to what other people are doing.
If you don't get 13, one of that top 13, yeah.
If someone takes a shortstop as a utility player, which I've seen happen,
then you can't be the last person to take.
You can't be the last person to take a shortstop.
And, then outfield, I think, is the clear one that you can wait on, and probably third base a little bit.
I will just point out with shortstops, Chris, that when we bring up that top 13, that's usually for roto, where we include guys like Javier Baez. Not that he's completely terrible in a points league, but he just walks so few times, yeah, and he strikes out.
Well,
so
Mondesi.
Much.
Mondesi's
and Mondesi
the
as well.
Yeah, exactly. Mondesi is the one who drops, yeah. I think, to that's so fair.
He's startable in this format, but he's not a standout.
And then there are, you know, you gotta remember there are guys like Anthony Rizzo, who is a little bit of an afterthought in roto at this point. I mean, he'll go like around 100 or a little later, but you know, he's a viable top 75 pick, if not earlier.
Oh, and I love getting him
to walk a ton.
Yep.
Max Muncy's someone who's probably a little better in points.
Reese Hoskins,
because he'll walk so much. And so you know, that's the other thing to keep in mind is there are guys like Adalberto Mondesi, Keston Hira, kind of for this. I like him a lot in both formats, but he's a lot riskier in head-to-head points, I think, because that strikeout rate could be so bad.
Yeah. Typically, you want to give a boost to players who have better plate discipline in a points league, at least based on the CBS scoring system, where you lose a point for a strikeout, you gain a point for a walk. So high OBP, the less strikeouts, the better for your hitters based on the CBS scoring system. The last thing I will mention about points leagues is quality starts, because they are you get bonus points for them based on the CBS scoring. And I think a lot of people, but just in general, if you play in any type of league that uses quality starts, I realize that we haven't talked a lot about quality starts. We did three starting pitcher previews and we didn't really talk about quality starts at all. So my bad, but
they're a result of pitching well.
Yeah.
We talk about the 6-inning threshold a lot. Yeah. And that's the hardest hurdle to clear for a quality start. So, you know, indirectly we talked about it, but yeah, I mean, like this format is where guys like Tyler Glasnow, Julio Urías,
Blake Snell definitely loses value in this format.
I don't know. Yeah. I'm hopeful the Padres handle him differently than the Rays did. Famously, Snell made 17 starts, including the playoffs last year, and didn't go 6 innings in one of them. So I get what you're saying. I'm just hopeful that changes now that he's with a different organization. But
I just don't know if that's a good thing, though.
Wishful thinking.
I feel like the Rays handled him well. They handled him the right way. They know something
that
we don't.
They handled him carefully.
Yeah.
But they lost the World Series.
that is also true. I wanted to just point out the the best pitchers in terms of quality starts the past 3 years. Chris sent this over to me, so appreciate it, Chris. But the top 12 in quality start percentage over the last three seasons with a minimum of 40 starts: Jacob DeGrom, Clayton Kershaw, Max Scherzer, Gerrit Cole, Hyunjin Ryu, Corey Kluber, Trevor Bauer, Shane Bieber, Zach Greinke, Steven Strasburg, Patrick Corbin, and Aaron Nola. So if you want to give those players a slight boost in a points league, that would probably make sense.
It's pretty much the best pitchers over the last
Years. So, you know, lower end guys that would deserve a similar boost, I think, would be like Dallas Keuchel and Marcus Stroman.
Yep.
Aaron Savala really is deep, actually. Aaron Savala has got a 60% quality start rate in his career.
I mean, we're drafting him no matter what. Like, get out of here, Scott, with your Savali's a bust. No more Savali slander on this podcast.
Brad Keller is going to be a surprisingly useful pitcher in this format. Like, I don't think he's must draft, but like, he's not going to be on the waiver wire for long.
Yeah, some guys who surprisingly rank relatively high: Miles Michaelis, 58% quality start rate over the last three seasons. Jose Berrios, you know, 55%. His is actually a little higher than Lucas Giolito, although his breakout came in 2019. Lance McCullers, surprisingly, 55%. I would have thought that would have been lower. He would have been a guy who I would have pegged for a lower one. He's ahead of guys like Noah Syndergaard, Blake Snell, Lance Lynn.
I think we just assume that he doesn't go deep because his innings pitched have been so low, but that's just because he gets hurt. I think when he actually pitches, he goes decently into his starts. So,
Brad Keller has a higher quality start rate than Walker Buehler over the last three seasons.
Walker Buehler.
Walker Buehler's 49th.
Watch that man in head-to-head points leagues or in any type of quality start leagues as well. But we told you that on our bus podcast yesterday. If you are watching on the video side, don't go anywhere. If you are listening on the podcast, we're going to take a quick break. But when we return, head-to-head categories leagues here on Fantasy Baseball Today.
The all-new Hyundai 2024 Santa Fe is equipped with everything you need to break free from the dull work week and embark on an adventurous weekend with your family. The all-new Hyundai Santa Fe's features like available H-Track all-wheel drive, standard third-row seating, available dual wireless charging pads. Nothing beats a weekend away with the family in the great outdoors, whether it's camping, hiking, river rafting, or anything in between. With third-row seating, nobody is left out. The entire family can experience the thrill together. And nobody wants a dead phone. Available dual wireless charging pads make it so nobody gets stuck and we can check our fantasy baseball teams together. Learn more about the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe at HyundaiUSA.com. Call 562-314-4603 for complete details. Worn by players like Michael Harris to meet the demand of elite ball players, the New Balance Fuel Cell 4040 V7 is a versatile option. The 4040 V7 is built for the athlete who needs responsiveness and ability to cut and run at their full speed. The model features a fuel cell foam underfoot and a synthetic and mesh upper to provide breathability, comfort, and a snug fit as you round the bases. The fuel cell midsole features nitrogen-infused foam specifically designed to propel athletes forward. Learn more about the 4040 at newbalance.com.
All right, so let's jump into head-to-head categories. This is where things just get completely weird. We've talked about the Marmol strategy a lot in the offseason, but head-to-head categories is basically a combination of rotisserie and head-to-head points. You're going up against one other opponent, but instead of accumulating fantasy points, you are competing against each other in just those 10 categories. Other people play with more than 10 categories. That's perfectly fine as well. We mentioned it on the Saturday mailbag, but there are two different types of head-to-head categories leagues. The first, and I believe to be more popular, is where if you beat your opponent in all 10 categories, your record becomes 10-0, and you just keep adding to that all season. If you win 9-1 in week two, your record then becomes 19-1. I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I just think it's the more popular format.
I'm saying it's a bad thing.
Chris doesn't like it. And then there's the traditional way to play where as long as you just win 6-4 every single week, you will get one win and your record will become 1-0. With all that being said, Chris, we will start with you with head-to-head categories. What is your strategy in this format? Do you like to build for balance? Will you actually punt a category? If you do like to punt, which category do you punt?
Yeah, punting's a lot easier. You can punt starting pitcher to start with. You can punt saves. You can punt stolen bases. It's a little harder to punt. Like you can't just punt strikeouts. If you're punting strikeouts, you're probably punting starting pitcher. If you're punting batting average, you can, but that usually, like, you can't really punt home runs. You can't really punt RBI. You can't really punt runs because those are so tied into the other types of hitting production.
I don't know that you can completely punt starting pitcher either. I don't know if you meant it literally, but there is a weekly innings minimum.
Right, right. No, I mean, like, not like not investing heavily. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you're never going to literally draft zero stolen bases. Unless you can you clone Eloy Jimenez?
Gosh, Chris, you hate him.
So you can punt, and I think that it's a viable strategy. I think it depends on whether it's that 10-0 or 1-0 weekly scoring, because if it's 10-0 and you keep winning 5.5 to 4.5, you're not going to really have a good team. If it's 1-0, then that's a different story because you can win 60% of your games 6-4. I'm definitely more likely to punt steals or saves in this format.
Yeah, I love punting steals. I mentioned it before. I like to target guys that contribute in batting average and sluggers. I mean, so like for every guy that you take that will hit home runs that will hurt your batting average, you try and get someone who will prop it back up. Someone like a Michael Brantley or an Alex Verdugo. But yeah, every time someone hits a home run, they impact four different categories. They impact your batting average, home runs, runs, and RBI. So those things are all correlated. And steals, I mean, it's just such a wacky stat. And it's especially, I mean, trying to predict steals for a season is hard enough. Trying to predict steals on a weekly basis is just impossible. So it's just completely lucky.
It's really the upcharge for steals that makes it worth doing. I've never been a proponent of punting categories, and I still don't think it's worth doing in Roto because you have to give yourself a chance to move up in all the different categories.
Correct.
Over the course of the season. But in this one, you know, that's not a thing. You're just going week by week with it. I think it makes sense. I think it makes sense as long as you're not, you know, gifted them in the first round with Ronald Acuna or Trey Turner or whatever. If you just happen to be in the right spot to take them, obviously you're not punting steals at that point. You're probably going to win steals a lot of the time. But if they don't come easily, you don't, like, denying yourself steals doesn't rob you of anything else. It's, you know, if you were to punt on starting pitcher, for instance, that's you're not giving yourself much of a chance in strikeouts or wins every week. But if you just punt steals, it's just steals, and you're actually gaining in the other categories by not paying up for the steals the way everybody else is.
And that's why steals and saves are the two easiest to punt, because they are the most independent of the other categories.
I get punting saves. I think that's true what you just said, but it goes back to what I was saying for Roto. I think it's such an easy category to do well in because there are new save sources constantly emerging.
And it also depends on if you're in I've played in head-to-head categories with standard Roto rosters where you start 14 hitters by position and then just 9 pitchers. In which case you can just go 9 starting pitchers. One thing that I do like to do is keep a flexible roster and look at the matchups. Because if I've got two relievers in my lineup and I look at the upcoming matchup and that guy doesn't have any relievers, I'll probably only start one of those relievers and, you know, try to get an extra starter in there to give myself a chance to compete in those wins and strikeout categories. And still, you know, hope that that guy gets a save that week, which, you know, it's never a guarantee.
I will once again remind people what the Marmol strategy is. We have talked about it a lot, but in case you've missed it, it is basically that you only draft relievers to put into your pitcher spots. And I think the standard Yahoo head-to-head categories lineup is 2 starting pitchers, 2 relief pitchers, and then just 4 pitchers. So that can be either starters or relievers. And there are some pitchers on Yahoo that have starting pitcher eligibility that are relievers. I think Diego Castillo has it, Seth Lugo. There's a few others. I think Jose Leclerc has it as well. But yeah, so you can get some relievers in your starting pitcher spots there as well. And the whole point here is you have to make sure your league has a low weekly innings minimum or no minimum at all to pull this off. And what you're doing is by not starting pitchers, you are punting wins and strikeouts. But the hope is that you dominate all other eight categories, including offense. So you use your first 10 picks in the draft or something along those lines on hitters. So theoretically, you should have an awesome offensive lineup. And then you just load up on the best relievers that are available.
Theoretically, but it's much harder to guarantee than I think it was in the years when the Carlos Marmol strategy was founded, when hitters came in a lot of different shapes and sizes. Now everybody's just, most every hitter is hitting between 25 and 35 home runs, you know. And when you're breaking it down into week by week and having to outperform the other guy in the small sample of a week, you know, just because you have the better hitters overall, which is, like I said, is hard to guarantee in the first place, it's even harder to guarantee over a tiny sample like that.
So I'm assuming you stay away from the Marmol strategy, Scott.
I was never in favor of it, even when I thought it was justified. I really don't think it's justified.
That's an insulting question.
Why? Why is that, Chris?
You would ask Scott if he would not draft starting pitchers? Come on.
Hey, maybe this is the one format where he doesn't have to worry about it, right? So,
no. One, Scott always worries in every format.
True.
Especially about starting pitcher.
Yeah. I mean, if he wasn't drafting starting pitchers, he would probably just be worried about not drafting enough relievers at that point. But,
I mean, it's funny that I've become this like starting pitcher proponent because I've been doing this, 13 years? Maybe it's my 14th. I don't know. It's been a long time. And for probably the first 8-9 years, I couldn't have been further in the opposite direction. Like, give me my ace in round 9, you know? And it's just,
I will say,
league's turned upside down.
You keep treating yourself like some iconoclast, like you're some brave truth teller. Everyone agrees with you now, Scott.
I know.
Like,
I know.
Starting pitchers cost more than ever.
I still want to go further than them, though. You know, you got people making pocket ace pitches for pocket aces. Like, that's not enough. That is not, I'm not saying you can't go with a starting pitcher with your first and second pick. That's fine. I'm just saying you can't rest on your laurels if you go starting pitcher first and second round.
I have mentioned before that I use this pseudo Marmol strategy that I like to call the 2x4, where I get two aces, two solid closers, two low end closers, and then two high end setup relievers, and then just load up my entire bench with upside arms. And I think it allows you to be competitive across the board. I used it in a league that I actually won, so that's why I like to stick with it at this point. We did a head-to-head categories mock just last week. You can find the results on the site, but here is what I wound up with using that strategy. Luis Castillo and Lucas Giolito were my two aces. Raisel Iglesias and Jordan Hicks were my two solid closers. Jose Leclerc and Brian Garcia were my two low-end closers. And then I had Devin Williams and Giovanni Gallegos as my two high-end setup relievers. On my bench, I had Julio Arias, Frankie Montas, Dallas Keuchel, Tony Gonsolin, and TJ Antone. So just hoping a few of those either hit or you just play the matchups, right? You don't have to start them. It's just you play them whenever they have good matchups. So,
one thing I would point out is, if you just do the math, 5 starting pitchers across 12 teams, technically you're not that undermanned at starting pitcher. You know, based on ADP, you've got 5 starting pitchers inside of the top 55.
It's just you're aiming.
It's a high low strategy, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like you're not necessarily sacrificing all that much. Like you got the 35th starter in ADP. You got the 48th and the 53rd. So.
And TJ Antone, who's going to finish as the number one pitcher this year. Gosh, he looks so good. I'm excited. I'm excited about TJ Antone.
He's not going to be in the rotation, Frank.
Don't say that. Can we just get Wade Miley out of here? Like, why are we doing the Wade Miley thing? It's 2021. Yeah,
that's true. Come on, man. I can't say Antone will never be in the rotation this year, But I don't think he's going to be at the start of the year. So he's going to get dropped in a lot of leagues. And, you know, you'll
pick him up
to scoop him up then. Yeah.
Pick him up. All right. Let's hit some salary cap drafts. Man, honestly, we could do 2 hours on just strategy. And I knew this was going to happen, but it's fine. There's a lot to talk about. Salary cap drafts. We could
do 2 hours on strategy for each of these formats.
Seriously. Yeah. There is never ending information. Salary cap drafts, formerly known as auctions. We actually got this email from Wes Hughes a couple of weeks ago asking a bunch of questions. So let's do this a little bit rapid fire style. And we will start with you this time, Chris. What is your nomination process in a salary cap draft? Do you nominate players you do not want so that everybody else has to spend their money? Do you like to mix it up? Do you maybe throw out a player here and there that you actually do want to get so you could spend some money? How do you do it?
Generally speaking, I go with a guy I don't want. I think occasionally there's value in throwing out, you know, very early on, a lower end guy who you like just to see if, you know, the beginning of a salary cap draft will go one of two ways. Either everyone will be a little gun shy for the first few players, or everyone will go nuts for the first few players. And so if you throw out a boring guy who you'd be fine getting for, you know, $5 like Anthony Rizzo, you might be able to get him for that price. Whereas, you know, if he went later in a draft when people knew how many first basemen were left, you know, it might push him up a little bit. So, but generally speaking, I prefer nominating guys I don't want.
Scott?
Yeah.
What do you think?
Look, I don't want to say I always nominate players I want because that's not something you want to reveal. And I don't anyway. I don't. There are times when I'm just looking to drain other people's money. And then obviously it makes sense to nominate somebody you don't want. But if my whole plan hinges on me getting a certain player, and, you know, I'm keeping myself from bidding on other players that could potentially be good values, because I'm counting on getting that player, I got to just put that player out there, because like it may be a lost cause. And then I've lost my chance to get all those other guys that would have been great. And you know, so that happens several times over the course of the auction. Like, okay, I want this one player. Everything I do is going to depend on whether or not I get this player. Let's just put the player out there.
I also like throwing players out at a position that I've already filled. So, you know, you're likely not going to be bidding on that player anyway, so you can get more money off of the table that way. Scott, when do you enter a bid for a player? Do you jump in early, or are you that person who waits until it gets down to like 2-1 and then you bid? Or do you change it up?
I mean, change it up. I don't usually purposely wait till it gets down to 2-1, because you don't know who else could jump in, and then you end up having to bid $2 up instead of $1, you know, if you wait too long. If there's a good volley back and forth, you know, me and one other guy just keep bidding each other up one, I might hesitate for like 3-4 extra seconds so that he thinks I'm like running out of steam in case he's trying to bid me up, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then if he bids me up right away after that, I'm like, whatever. But that's really the only time where I consciously wait to put in the bid.
This is one of those things that I just acknowledge is like, is something I'm not great at with auctions, is I definitely telegraph, especially if like anytime we've done like salary drafts in the office back when I worked down there and it was me and Heath in the same room, Heath would troll me so much on it because he knew, you know, one, which players I want. And then he knew that I hate when people wait until the last second. It just, you know, when you got ADHD, like it's just like that 10 second clock just takes forever when you got to wait again and again. And now, so,
now I know you've gotten on me when I might be,
I've
waited till the last second, but that is because I literally needed till the last second to decide.
No, that's the thing is some people do it, but like, this is the fun thing about this format is there's the psychology factor involved, and you can, you know, try to psych the people that you're drafting without by waiting longer or hitting the button immediately. Or, you know, I know RJ White, our boss, he just does the jump bid. Like if he thinks a player's worth $35, he's not going to sit around doing this 5, 6, 7, 8. He'll just hit $25, which again, as someone who, you know, for whom patience is not a strong suit, I appreciate that.
I'm writing all these things down, Chris, because we actually have a live salary cap draft podcast that we're going to do coming up soon. So that it's going to be wild.
I think I handle myself in salary cap drafts better than Scott does. Scott always just devolves immediately into self-loathing in the middle of the salary cap
draft. Yeah, I spend most of every salary cap draft thinking I've ruined everything. And then there comes a point, usually about, you know, 3/4 of the way through, where it's like, okay, all right, this is starting to shape up okay. But I usually do something early on or miss a chance to do something early on that just eats me up for the next hour and a half.
And this is the kind of thing where you can look at our salary values on the ranking site. You can look at the, what was it, head-to-head points salary cap draft that we did last week. And you can use those as a guide, but there's only so much value you can get from them, because you'll have, you know, some guys just go for way less than they should. Some guys go for way more. So, you know, that's another thing to keep in mind when you're looking at those results.
You learn so much about how it's going to go just from getting in there and seeing the way the first few bids go, because, you know, if you see, the high end guys all going for way, this is really what all projected salary cap values are about, is to know how to calibrate your expectations, really. Yeah. Is what I think that all they're like, if the top players are going for $5 to $10 more than what they're projected to go for,
you got to adjust.
Okay, there's going to be some good values later.
Yeah.
And maybe you shouldn't invest in as many of them as you'd planned. If it's the other way around, then okay, go total stars and scrubs, because you're going to overpay for some middling guys just because there's going to be too much money on the table later.
You have to be able to account for inflation, basically. Is, yes, use them as a guide in our draft kit. You can find all of our salary cap values, and you should have those going into your draft. And you should, you know, I usually like to plan out a whole thing. I have a bunch of different targets and players that I want, and I have an idea of what I want to spend. But say a player within that tier early on goes for $5 to $10 more, as Scott said, you have to be able to adjust and know, okay, well, I don't want to be completely left out. If I am going to spend more money up here to get my player, so be it. That means, you know, some of the mid-tier players or even lower-end players are going to go for cheaper than they should. But just don't be completely scared off when you see players go for more. You have to adjust for that inflation.
You have to be flexible in salary cap drafts more than any other format.
I did just want to ask, are you guys more likely to go with a stars and scrubs approach in a salary cap draft, or do you like to go with a more balanced approach? Say, you know, the $15 to $30 players, because for me, it's dependent on how deep the league is. I have a 15-team roto league that I play in every single year, and I will not spend more than $35 on a player, if that. I mean, I really live in the $20 to $30 range, and I just I want to be more balanced than anything. I don't want to pay up in that type of format, because you pay up, next thing you know, that player gets hurt. The replacement value in a deeper league is much worse than if it's in a 10 or 12-team league.
Well, and it also makes a difference what the scrubs actually look like. I mean, a scrub, a $1-$2 scrub in a 12-team roto league could be, you know, Jock a high-profile sleeper. It could be who, Chris?
Like Jock Peterson, who might hit 35.
Oh, it could be even somebody better than that, just depending, because somebody's, if people overpay for the studs, there's going to be really good players that go for cheap. And then you also have the waiver wire. Like the key to stars and scrubs, or studs and duds, whatever you call it, is that your scrubs aren't actually going to be scrubs in the end, whether because they're just good values in the draft itself, or because you know good options are going to emerge on the waiver wire that you'll get to fill those spots later on. So if it's such a deep league that the scrubs are really scrubs, or that they're little waiver wire to speak of, then you have to balance your dollars a little more, because you can't afford to have those holes. So I would say 15 team mixed or deeper, I try to balance more, certainly AL, NL only. I mean, I might not get any real stars in those formats, because I'm so concerned about filling all the spots with the budget I have. But, you know, 12 teams or fewer, definitely stars and scrubs.
All right, let's do some rapid fire. I still have so much, but we'll just try to get to as many of these things in the next, you know, 5 to 10 minutes. Let's talk a little dynasty. Scott, what is your approach in, if you're doing a startup dynasty draft, are you, when, like, this is, I, there's no way to do this fast. I don't even know why I said it, but whatever, however long you want to talk, Scott, tell me what, okay, what your approach would be in a startup dynasty draft. Are you more of like a win now? Do you look at like a 3 to 5 year window? Do you take all top prospects and you punt years 1 and 2? I mean, there are so many different ways to win in dynasty.
Yeah, and I've started a few before, and you know, I have dynasty rankings, the top 150. I actually just updated it, and you'll probably notice that you're not going to get the highest end prospects if you follow those dynasty rankings. I know some people like to do a dynasty startup, just loading up on prospects and just tanking the first couple years. I don't think there's any reason to do that. You know, most of the high end players are young guys in their mid 20s. You know, like they're going to be, like, form a nucleus you can actually believe in because they're proven and they're going to help you win right now. And I'm not saying I sell out for right now. I've built a solid nucleus of 20 somethings that I know are good. And then I take whatever values fall on both ends of the spectrum, because a lot of 30 somethings are going to fall. And then, you know, kind of those second tier prospects are going to fall. A lot of them are going to end up being great values. And so I just gobble up the values wherever I see them on both ends of the spectrum. But, you know, my goal is to always contend in a dynasty league, always. So you don't want to, neglect anything really. If you build a strong core, when other guys aren't, that's going to give you trade assets too, that you can then, like, but trading is such a part of my dynasty strategy. It's really the format where I invest the most time in trading, and I'm always trading for next year is kind of a goal of mine. And if you're always trading for next year, pretty soon you're going to be so strong in the current year that it's kind of hard to mess up at that point.
Chris, not in Dynasty League, just in general, how do you handle FAB, which is free agent acquisition budget, in season, in a minute or less? Are you aggressive early? Do you save it for the long haul? How do you approach FAB?
I think you probably want to be more aggressive early. You know, you're always, I think there's kind of a, you know, you can always save it for the next big guy, but if it's a need that you have right there and it can be an impact player, I don't really see much reason to hold out, because for one thing, if your week two, FAB bid hits, you're getting 23 weeks out of them.
Correct.
Whereas if your week 12 won, that being said, early season guys can get overrated. And you can have, I'm thinking of like Matt Davidson hitting 5 home runs in the first 4 games or whatever it was a couple years ago, or there was someone last year who had a really, really great start.
I think Joe Jimenez had a save for each of the first 3 games, and he might have ended the season with 3 saves.
Yeah, and so that's one of the things that you just always have to keep in mind early in the season, and it's not just for FAB, is just don't overreact to the first week. The early results don't necessarily mean anything more, and that's always a really hard thing to keep in mind. But if it is a situation where, let's say we get to opening day, Cleveland hasn't announced who their closer is, and all of a sudden Nick Whitgren gets the first 2 saves, you probably want to put in a pretty hefty bid on him. You don't want to be conservative there, because that guy's good enough to be the closer all year long.
Yeah, typically.
So I think it depends on the situation.
Yeah, typically I'm more aggressive early on. If you hit on a stud, as you mentioned, you have him for a longer portion of the season. So that's usually how I look at it. But I will point out that, yes, prospects are going to go for a ton of money in FAB, but they usually get called up further into the season, first month, second month. I remember a couple of years ago, Yordan Alvarez, I mean, he didn't break out until that year, and then he came up, I think, in June or July, and he was the league winner for a lot of people.
What I would say is you don't want you don't want to blow all your fab before the prospects get called up, which is, you know, there are, we generally know when that's going to happen. It's like after the first 2 weeks of the season, a handful of them will get called up, and then starting in the middle of May for the Super 2 guys. So you don't want to blow all of it before that crop comes up, but you don't necessarily want to get past that point with a significant amount of your fab left, because then the opportunities are going to be rarer and rarer for those impact players. But
there are two things to keep in mind with how you distribute your fab dollars over the course of the year. In my mind, the rest of your league is never going to be more interested than at the start of the year.
Yeah.
And we're never going to know less about the season that's about to unfold than at the start of the year. So there are going to be
especially
more impact players that you can get earlier, and there's going to be less competition for your fab later. So, you know, if it's a league that allows $0 bids, I might spend half my budget in the first 6 weeks and then slow way down because there's less competition for it, you know?
Fair enough.
Yeah. And you know, this season, especially, we're not going to know anything, you know, early on. We don't really know what the impact of the deadened ball will be, if it will have an impact at all. We're coming off a 60-game season, so we don't know who was real and who was fake last season. So there's going to be more turnover, I would think, at the back end of most rosters this year than last year because of those factors in particular.
All right, we're going to wrap there. Let us know what you think, everybody. Did you enjoy our first ever just full show dedicated to strategy? If you do, hopefully we'll make it an annual thing that we do right before the season get started. For Scott and Chris, I am Frank. Thank you all for listening and watching Fantasy Baseball Today. We'll be back again tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.